philosopher and bioethicist at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, the director of the Center for Bioethics and Health Law, a professor of human genetics in the Graduate School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh, really an expert on this subject, as she mentioned. You know, she doesn't claim to be an expert geneticist, scientist, but really an expert in bioethics. And we are very fortunate to have her. We've been looking forward to this now for years. and the day has finally come, and she's going to talk to us about how some things matter more than genes when we're talking about genomics. So with that, I just say thank you for being here, and we are so looking forward to what you have.
Well, thank you so very much. And we keep finding small blessings from this pandemic. And I guess having someone look forward to a talk I'm going to give for years is a distinctive benefit, if you will, of this pandemic for me. I'm going to work on sharing my screen. Share, and I'm going to see why it is looking a little different from what I want it to. There. All right. And now to go to a slideshow, and we'll see what I can do here. So, I am indeed the director of the Center for Bioethics and Health Law at Pitt, and I'm just delighted that you have invited me to join you this morning. I promise that in subsequent Sundays, I won't talk maybe as much as I might today. I've tried to keep this short, but it is sometimes a little bit of a challenge. I realized I didn't bring my clock in with me, so I will try to keep track of time. I want to talk about precision medicine and how it's not really just only or primarily genomic medicine. Talk about different types and uses of genetic testing or genomic sequencing and the benefits and limitations of precision medicine. Discuss some direct-to-consumer testing and then talk a bit about genetic information and what its benefits and limitations are. So I wanted to begin by clarifying that I'm probably going to use genetic and genomics somewhat interchangeably, but that genetics refers to the study of genes and their roles in inheritance. And a gene is this unit of the heredity that carries the instructions for making proteins, directing activities of cells and the functions of the body. Whereas genomics has come to be a more recent term. It's come to mean the study of all of a person's genes, the genome, or the human genome, a composite of a number of people who were studied to map the genome. And we talk about the genome interacting with environment, so a gene-environment interaction, both at individual and population levels, indeed at cellular levels. So we can talk about environments in a bunch of different ways. Uterine, a physical environment, the social built environment, a chemical environment, the environment of a polluted environment around us, or of, you know, secondhand smoke, and behavioral environments. We sometimes talk about lifestyle factors as an environmental factor. So back when I got into this, coming out of graduate school, in the early 90s and getting my first job or second job, in the Department of Human Genetics at Pitt. We were launching the Human Genome Project, and James Watson made this famous comment that we used to think that our fate was in our stars, but now we know that in large measure, our fate is in our genes. And then Bill Clinton came along and in 1996 commented that I think it won't be too many years before parents will be able to go home from the hospital with their newborn babies with a genetic map in their hands that will tell them, here's what your child's future will be like. But then we get the reality that where you live, your zip code, what you can report on your tax return probably actually has a lot more to do with you and your child's health than your genes. Well, with some exceptions, obviously. So there are indeed some genetic conditions that pretty well overwhelm the other factors in one's life. But those are rather rare conditions. So since the Human Genome Project ended in 2003 at a cost of approximately $2.7 billion or $5 billion in today's dollars, the cost of sequencing genomes, individual genomes, has come way, way, way down. Till we talk about the $1,000 genome. And the reality is that in a laboratory or in a commercial laboratory, a clinical laboratory, sequencing is really less than $1,000. You may get billed for more than that, but it's actually less. So it's cheap. And part of the problem, I would say, is that it is relatively inexpensive to sequence a whole genome and therefore to actually create a whole lot of information when what you really want to know is maybe just about this part of the genome, a particular gene. So there are a range of trade-offs to be made, but people will say, why should I do a cancer panel to learn my risks for cancer when I can sequence my whole genome and learn about my risks for heart disease and diabetes and whether I can taste cilantro or not? I can learn so much more. So part of what I want to discuss is, you know, the challenges, if not the problems, really, of learning so much more. On the other hand, or maybe the same hand, I want to talk about the precision medicine initiative, or more generally, really, precision medicine. So President Obama announced the Precision Medicine Initiative. And Pitt's version of that, if you see the truck around or you see signs in windows, All of Us is the new name for the research platform that Obama announced as his precision medicine initiative. He announced it in 2015 in his State of the Union address. It goes along with his BRAIN initiative as two signature research-oriented contributions of his administration, along with the Affordable Care Act, to really try to launch the United States with into, you know, the ranks of the world's cultures that really attend to health and provide for the health of the diversity of our population. And one of the things I'll talk about is, you know, how well we're doing with that, or how well that was conceptualized. So what is precision medicine, the website said? Well, it's medicine tailored to you. A bold new initiative in the research side to revolutionize how we improve health and disease. And so Obama, in presenting and selling this initiative, said this about precision medicine. The doctors have always recognized that every patient is unique. They've always tried to tailor their treatments as best as they can to individuals. And what if matching a cancer cure to our genetic code was just as easy and just as standard as matching a blood type for a blood transfusion? What if it was as simple as taking our temperature? And as most things that are promised to be simple, it's not. For all of the publicity around precision medicine, or what was initially called personalized medicine, it's really a version of the medicine we've always had. Well, maybe not always had, but have in modern times, where we hope that our medicine is evidence-based. where it's a medicine is a matter of integrating individual clinical expertise with the best available external clinical evidence from systematic research. Now, anyone here who practices medicine or has thought about or dug into it a little bit probably knows that a whole lot of what is prescribed for us, recommended to us, may not in fact have come out of a systematic research, but has emerged out of anecdotal clinical practice over time. But as we have moved into the later 20th and now 21st century, there is a move to have more and more to have systematic research inform our clinical practice guidelines. But the point really is that all of this is epidemiologically based, that whether it's anecdotal based on a physician's experience with past patients who look like me, have my same symptoms, are approximately my age, and so on, or whether it's a clinical trial of people who are relevantly similar to me in terms of my symptoms and other characteristics. What's recommended to me by my physician is based on what was true of them. And you don't really know whether it's going to be true of me, but it's epidemiologically population-based. And we hope that it will apply equally well to me. The idea with personalized or precision medicine is to more fine-tune those populations about whom we gather information that we then apply to the individual. So importantly, personalized or precision medicine refers to the tailoring of medical treatment to the individual characteristics of each patient. It does not literally mean the creation of drugs or medical devices that are unique to the patient, but rather the ability to classify individuals into subpopulations that differ in their susceptibility to a particular disease, in the biology or the prognosis of those diseases they may develop, or in their response to a particular treatment. Then preventive or therapeutic interventions can be concentrated on those who will benefit, sparing expense and side effects for those who will not. So that is indeed the point of precision medicine, is to try to separate out those who will or are likely to, they should be more specific, are most likely to benefit from those who most likely will not. But so that's one reason that I say that personalized precision medicine is really stratified medicine. It's a matter of stratifying people into subpopulations. But stratified medicine doesn't sound very good. And that's partly because our experience with stratification in this country, in this world, has generally led to a lot of social injustice. So this is a comment by Harold Edgar about the Human Genome Project back when it was ongoing. And he said that the Human Genome Project will bring to the forefront of human consciousness awareness of the range of variability, not only among individuals, but among groups. And to acknowledge these differences while insisting on their irrelevance for individual dignity and equality of right is a challenge we shall have to face. And I always try to work in this wonderful quotation because Harold Edgar, and if this were a class and we were being a little more interactive at this point more easily, I'd say, now, do you know who he is? And he is the lawyer who represented men from the Tuskegee syphilis study in their seeking of damages from the federal government for their having been enrolled in a study for 40 years under what became to be clearly deceptive, misleading circumstances, without true informed consent and without benefiting them for their condition of so-called bad blood or syphilis. So the fact that he will point out that our dividing of our country, our populations into subpopulations has not always been advantageous for populations is an important point to keep in mind. But at the same time, we very strongly in this country think that having information about our health empowers us. So if you go online now, you can get the Mother's Day special and give your super mom even more power over her health by getting her genome tested with 23andMe. Now they're one of a number of direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies. They're not yet sequencing the whole genome, but they do a wide panel of genetic tests to provide a range of information. It's easy, as they say, it's simple. All from home, no blood, no needles. You just order, you spit, and discover in 3 to 5 weeks what you want to know that they have available to tell you. So as they say, here's the kit. It's you, your specimen bag, your funnel for you know, spitting and so on. It's advertised as welcome to you, welcome to your genes. And one of the important things to keep in mind is your genes are not you. It is a matter of genes and environment, where environment must be understood very broadly. But they will, for $99 or so, supply you with information based on your genes about your likely ancestry, where you hailed from, where your ancestors hailed from, and various traits, as I said, like can you taste cilantro? Is it distasteful to you? Bitter taste, qualities of your earwax, and so on. Also, there's a health component that you may spend more money for. And that fact, back in the day, so earlier in the 2000s, the fact that 23andMe and other companies were giving health-related information led to some concerns. So the GAO, Government Accounting Office, conducted a study, and they had 5 fake customers who sent their samples to 4 direct-to-consumer companies and received back information about 15 diseases. In 4 of 5 cases, the results conflicted with their actual disease condition, where had the test been accurate, there should have been a finding of risk for or presence of a genetic disease. And one of the men, one received an increased risk of prostate cancer, 1 a decreased risk, and 2 average risk. So these inconsistent results led the Government Accounting Office to report, you know, you should be really skeptical about these companies. And they sent a cease and desist order for a while to these direct-to-consumer companies to get their acts together and do more testing, which they did. And now they probably are, in fact, much more accurate than in the past, at least with regard to a range of people. And so in our next discussion, we'll talk about the role that ancestry plays in the accuracy of some of the findings. But the FDA does now permit the marketing of direct-to-consumer testing for, you know, health conditions. And there are a range of companies, and some are more focused on providers and the interaction or the dyad of patients and providers. Some are more like 23andMe, a bit more commercial and consumer oriented. This Invitae focuses on health-related genes solely, and looks at ancestry only insofar as that is relevant for interpreting test results. So they'll offer pregnancy, preventive health information, cancer testing. So you could go to them if you have a cancer diagnosis and engage in or receive relevant information. And so Invitae really offers kind of a range of the types of genomic testing that's available today. Diagnostic testing, whether it's for a single gene or a panel of genes like the cardiac panel or the cancer panel of genes, those genes that have been identified as being relevant to cardiac disease or to a range of cancers. It could be whole genome sequencing, it could be the whole exome, what's considered to be the most informative part of the genome. But they can show carrier screening, whether a person carries a gene that could in offspring manifest in a genetic condition. For an individual who has symptoms, testing can help to resolve a diagnostic odyssey. This, what do I have going from one specialist to the next? Is it chronic fatigue syndrome? Is it lupus? It could help to resolve a quest to figure out what's going on. But also, and I think what we'll talk about in the next two times, very importantly, it helps, there are tests available for the predictive testing for susceptibility to disease. Whether that's like BRCA testing, BRCA1 and 2 for breast cancer, APOE for aortic aneurysm, and also for Alzheimer's disease, testing for Huntington disease and so on, but also polygenic risk score testing, where there's testing to look at multiple genes across the genome, each of which has a small effect on, for example, risk of cardiac problems. And right now, polygenic risk scores are not being much used in clinical care, I think for good reason. And in our third discussion, we'll talk about that some more. But overall, the idea with predictive testing is to identify clinically actionable conditions, risks for conditions, where people can take action somehow by taking a cholesterol lowering drug, by having more frequent cancer screening, or simply to inform decisions. Do I want to get long-term care insurance? Do I not think I need long-term care insurance, for example? And then the other two types of testing, talk a little bit about next times, pharmacogenomic testing for response to drugs, and tumor testing to type the tumor and hope to guide treatment in the case of cancer. But all of these testings create information that, I like this slide better, excuse me, that I think raise questions about our right and our opportunity to control access to and the use of personal information about ourselves. Now, from an ethical perspective, I mean, it may seem perfectly obvious why we care about our privacy, but to articulate those reasons, I think is valuable. One reason we care about the privacy of, say, our health information and other personal information is to protect us from harm to our reputation, to our relationships. Maybe I don't want my husband to know where I was last weekend. Maybe that's going to protect my relationship. You might think, oh, I was having an affair, but then again, maybe I was consulting someone about domestic abuse. Actually, my husband's a great guy, but and not only a great guy, but non-abusive. But if he found out where I was, this hypothetical husband, that might be severely harmful to not only our relationship, but to my health, economic interests. So all of these reasons are kind of consequence oriented, but there's one big consequence as well related to privacy. And that is that if too much is known about a person, we don't have that kind of private sphere in which we can develop our own personalities, our own life plans. We think of teenagers and the reasons that they go off into their rooms and spend so much time alone figuring things out and trying things out with maybe a friend or a circle of friends away from parents and what I'm calling the crippling public gaze or the parental gaze, away from judgment. And that privacy is really important. And what does this have to do with genetics? well, I may want to keep my reproductive risks for future disease in my children very, very private, because I don't want my parents or my husband's parents or our next door neighbors saying, now, why did you have a child again, knowing that your child might develop XYZ. So genetics really does give rise to the opportunity for public judgment. And developing information about oneself through genetic testing gives rise to sources of risks to our privacy. And the main source is probably that people disclose things about themselves. But also, someone could be careless. Someone in a professional could be careless. There are opportunities and occasions where there have been malicious hacking into databases, but also just non-malicious, but nevertheless unwelcome seeking of information, like insurers who may have an interest in genetic information to be able to use it for actuarial purposes. Now, 23andMe says your privacy is our priority, and I think that's true. And they point out right there in the middle of this slide that there is a federal law that protects genetic information from use by employers or health insurers. So, you know, they've anticipated these risks to privacy. At the same time, that federal legislation, GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, does not apply to life, long-term care, disability, or automobile insurance. Like automobile, why would my auto insurance want to know about my genetics? Well, as we move toward greater understanding of behavioral factors, or even understanding of some diseases that affect response times, mobility issues, my automobile insurance might have a great deal of interest. Also, as 23andMe says, subpoena and court orders are exceptions. They will supply information to in response to court orders, not to law enforcement alone. So, is that a problem? We don't currently have a court that gives a credence to genetic testing information to order, for example, in a context of a divorce, that I disclose my genetic information. But if my husband were asking for that, and in some future time, maybe he could seek that information about me and say my risks for future disease in arguing that I should not have custody of our children. So as they point out, security really matters. And in general, there is, you know, very good security. People, you know, make careers of avoiding or preventing hacking into databases, encrypting information, creating firewalls, for example, between my employer, the University of Pittsburgh, and UPMC Health Plan, which is my insurer. There's a firewall so that Pitt can't find out, you know, my health information. But at the same time, as we know across the top of this slide, there are a whole lot of data breaches that are reported. And as we go down the list, I mean, Wikipedia, you can look it up, has a list of data breaches that have been reported. And Ancestry.com figures there from 2015 as having had 300,000 records hacked into due to poor web security. Massachusetts General similarly had their database in their neurology department hacked into by, we don't know by whom, but that nearly 10,000 people had their records affected. Moreover, and I mentioned malicious hacking. Well, this wasn't malicious, but someone who wanted to prove it could be done for reasons, kind of the white hat types who wanted to prove it could be done so that security could be improved, hacked into a genealogy database, and using information there were able to identify who had contributed, even though the data there were de-identified, but they pieced together information of personal information of zip code, health condition, relationship to others in the family tree, and could figure out who these actually anonymous DNA donors were. So coming up, we'll talk about the role of ancestry in relevance for predicting genetic risk. We'll talk a bit about parentage and misattributed parentage and incidental findings that can arise in doing genetic testing for one condition, but discovering other information. And overall, we'll talk about the value of predictive genetic testing and precision medicine. And I don't want to leave today with the impression that I think it's not useful at all, but I'm more skeptical of it than many of my colleagues in genetics are. I then want to go on and have us talk a little bit about how the missing link, and that's just to use the term from evolution, but the missing link for precision medicine is, I think, behavioral, that we don't have adequate understanding of behavioral factors of how to make good use of information. It's not a genetic missing link. We don't necessarily need more and more and more genetic information, but need to begin to figure out what to do with much of what we have, like those polygenic risk scores for susceptibility to disease. So we'll talk a little bit as well about precision public health, what it means to perhaps individualize social problems. And then in the fourth time that we're together, I'd like to talk about a less medically oriented topic, but the whole notion of genetic enhancement and what that tells us about issues of social justice, about our belief in and reliance on merit in many of our social structures, and particularly the problems of so-called playing God with genetics and concerns for parents, decisions that they need to make. So having kind of whipped quickly through raising some issues, I think I've returned to maybe have discussion. Am I back and no longer sharing?
Yes, we can see you.
Good. The question is, the question is about questions. I realize I was pretty broad. And even at the risk of maybe, as we'd say, conflating or confusing certain things that should have been kept more separate, like the Precision Medicine Initiative, which is a research platform, versus precision medicine, which is something that the whole field is trying to develop in the direction of. But questions or comments?
Well, I'll just start out by saying thank you for this. What a wonderful overview and so much to think about. I have a list of like 8 things here, so I won't dominate. But one of the things that I want to ask you about just to start is the phrase you use, and you put it in quotation marks. So I'd like to understand the source of the quote and a little bit more of the detail around it. The notion of a crippling public gaze, because some people suffer from health conditions that are obvious to public gaze, and they have no protection from that crippling public gaze. And then there are genetic conditions or conditions that are not available for public inspection, where they have that option of protection from public gaze. So I'd really like to understand what you're thinking about there.
Right. Well, the person who coined the phrase, I think, it's either Ruth Hoverson, who's a law professor, or Thomas Nagel, a philosopher, one or the other of them. And they weren't talking about genetics or really health at all. But we're talking about, for example, the difficulty of, take a potentially taboo subject of developing my sexuality in the light of the public that doesn't want me to act like a tomboy or act like a boy, that doesn't want me perhaps to love a woman, but wants me to love and be loved by a man, who doesn't want me to, you know, love a much older man, for example, or a much younger. So the idea of our social norms being that crippling gaze. Now you took that, as I hoped you would, in the direction of health and health conditions as well. And certainly some are visible. Many physical disabilities are mobility disabilities. You may or may not be able to discern that someone has difficulty hearing or more trouble seeing or discerning colors, right? All of these different disabilities. We may or may not notice them. Mental health disabilities might be, you know, suspected but not known, but we're harsh about them. We are both concerned, but also as a culture, hard on people who are depressed or who hear voices or have an alternate reality within which they operate, as well as our own shared reality. And so I think that's the notion of this crippling public gaze, and that whether or not we can kind of hide obvious what's considered to be disabling or just anomalies or differences, indeed is important for getting through the world. Part of what's significant about genetics is that although some conditions are visible and they may or may not be related to genes, other conditions have this genetic component that's predictive. And so even before I act depressed, the thought is, well, you might be able to predict that I'm going to be depressed. And so as a young person, you can monitor me and you can worry about my moodiness and you can worry about the people I'm hanging out with. When actually, maybe, yeah, I might have some predisposition toward depression, but actually this is just normal teenage moodiness. So, and I also want to caution that I use that as an example because it's a good one, but we don't have good understanding at all of genetic components of most mental health conditions, including depression. That was just a hypothetical example.
Thank you, that was very helpful. Other people, you can certainly unmute yourself whenever you want. We're leaving cameras off for now.
Can I just say something in your slide, one of your slides about assessing multiple genes as opposed to, I mean, you know, in textbooks, they always talk about the gene that controls eye color. Mm-hmm. And it never quite seemed right to me, but I can see how complex it could get. Is that the issue with correlating multiple genes to something of interest?
Yeah. So there are multiple issues with trying to correlate, and you, good word, right? Associating, right? It's association, not causation in most cases, of one or more genes with a condition. And so, for example, there is this gene, BRCA1, that can have a bunch of different variations. Some of those variations are indeed correlated with an increased risk for breast cancer. But then there are also other genes that are correlated with an increased risk for breast cancer. So once we've discovered those, we might also test for them at the same time. And this is what I'm talking about in terms of a cancer panel. You might test for all of the known, at this time, they're more on their way maybe, all of the known breast cancer genes when you're trying to figure out maybe my risk for breast cancer, or if I have breast cancer, you test other members of my family to try to discover, you know, what their risks, my sons, my daughters, what are their risks for having breast cancer. Or you might not be concerned solely with breast cancers, but all of the genes that are associated with a bunch of different known cancers, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, breast cancer, so a cancer panel. And then there's another sense in which there are And what you're doing there is you're looking to see which one or a couple a family has or a person has. But there's also the case where you just look at me and you could search to see, do I have an increased risk for cardiovascular disease? And this is emerging, polygenic risk scores. There's no one gene that we think is as significant for cardiovascular disease as there are genes significant for Tay-Sachs, for cystic fibrosis, where you have a single gene, changes in that gene may indeed be, you know, a major contributor to developing the condition and how severe it is and so on. But it may be a bunch of little genes in my genome that taken together with my diet and my lifestyle and the fact that I've been smoking a pack a day for the last 20 years gives me a high risk for cardiovascular disease. So there are a couple of different senses of multiple genes involved. And that last one of the polygenic risk score is really reliant on small contributions by a number of genes plus environment like my diet and my smoking and my age to predict then how much more likely am I to develop cardiovascular disease than someone else in my similar, well, being female and age group.
Yeah. I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think I'm a suspicious person, but you know, I'm wondering if this information were to be available legally or even illegally to insurance companies. And they might perhaps make decisions on insuring certain people based on that. I mean, for the moment, I think we're somewhat protected from pre-existing conditions. But if that protection weren't there, your pre-existing condition would be before you were born. So I just wonder if that's a, does that come up?
Yes. So it's a good insight, and it's one that was recognized. And that's one reason that GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, was passed into law. It's also a reason, I think, that President Obama's Affordable Care Act protection against increasing rates or refusing health insurance for pre-existing conditions, that's the actual manifest condition, but also then GINA addressing the genetic information that might suggest that someday I will manifest a condition. Both of those were, you know, supported, they're popular with the public. It's in place. Now it's only in place though for health insurance and employers who cannot hire or fire based on genetic information. So long-term care insurance, disability insurance to replace your income if you lose your job because you have a severely debilitating condition, disease, those insurers could still use genetic information. And if we think about it, that's in some sense, makes sense. It's really integral to the whole insurance industry, life insurance industry, disability insurance industry, to be able to predict who's going to be expensive and charge them more money. That's why, you know, older people get charged more for life insurance if they buy it at that later date. Why? Well, because it's more likely that they're going to pay in for a brief time before the end of their lives and the company has to pay out. Well, the same could be true if I engage in really risky behaviors, like I'm going off to fight in a war. I'm a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL. My insurance rate should be pretty high compared to someone who's a civilian with a desk job. I'm not sure that's actually true and the government has benefits, but as an example, well, What about health-related risks? Well, similar to being shot at, you know, my genetically related and lifestyle risks can increase the risk of early death and an insurance company needing to pay out or needing to pay out to keep me in long-term care for a longer period of time. It's interesting that President Obama did want to put long-term care insurance into the Affordable Care Act. So imagine the difficulties that would have occurred had he tried to put, you know, nursing home care, long-term care into that as well. But it's obviously integral to our healthcare system, but currently is outside of it. And genetic information can be used to underwrite, you know, to set the rates for those different types of insurances.
So in other words, if I have a genetic risk of Alzheimer's, then and I want to buy long-term care insurance, if as the genetic prediction of Alzheimer's risk gets better and better, I can be born in such a way that I can never buy long-term care insurance.
Exactly. And it is suggested that people who are interested in learning risks like that, information about risks like that, should get their life insurance and their long-term care insurance first, before they know. Now, on the other hand, if you're in a family where people have had Alzheimer's disease early in their lives, earlier onset, the insurance company may be asking questions about that even without any requirement of genetic testing or looking through your health records to see whether you've had genetic testing. So, and you don't want to lie on an insurance form because that is not only wrong, but can negate the paying out on the contract because it was under, you know, false conditions.
Other questions?
Yeah, other questions. That predicting of the onset of, or you know, the likelihood of developing later life dementia or early onset dementia is clearly one of the things that is controversial, but that a lot of people are somewhat interested in, because even though there may not be a whole lot, actually there is not a whole lot to do to prevent the onset of dementia, no sort of magic pill. Nevertheless, there's a lot of life planning, as you pointed out, that a person could engage in. And so looking at family history, looking at lifestyle factors, and looking at genetic information to try to determine whether one's at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease, for example, is indeed something that people want to consider. And I have a colleague, for example, who wants to, or who sought to know her Alzheimer's disease risk because she wanted to plan her death prior to the onset of disease.
So while others are thinking of further questions, I have one that I'd like you to comment on. You made allusions to the interaction of environment, genes, and behavior. This is a theme that I see a lot. Something that's quite relevant to this, to the context of this seminar. And then there's the quote from Isaac Singer that kind of relates to this. It says, "I have no choice but to believe in free will."
Yeah.
So, you know, I think culturally we like to think that we have free will and that our behavior determines our fate. But we also know that our genetic risk plays a role, and that genetic risk interacts with our environment. And oftentimes that combination of genes and environment interact much more, have a much bigger influence than individual choices that we make. I know you're going to talk about this in the third week, and I can't wait. I'd really like to get your sort of thoughts about the sort of classic argument of nature versus nurture.
Sure. So, and the question of free will, that really profound, deep question, relates to nature versus nurture, but only relates. They're not the same thing exactly. One can talk about nature versus nurture as, you know, a balancing of the two, of genes and environment, examining, you know, which has in particular cases greater influence. It is true, for example, that if I have the gene, mutations in the gene for Huntington disease, related to Huntington disease, I will, if I live long enough, develop Huntington disease. That's epidemiologically based information, as all of this information is, but it looks as though that's 100%. Now, when it will actually occur has a lot to do with what the precise, you know, mutations are, how many repeats there are, so on. But, you know, that will occur. Now, you could say that's nature. It's absolutely, you know, controlled, it's destiny. But within that parameter, I have a whole lot of decisions to make. Do I want to have children and risk passing on the gene to them? Do I want to become an artist? Do I want, you know, all of these other things? Do I want to, you know, live hard and die young? Or do I think, well, you know, I'm not going to embrace, you know, my fate, and I'm going to kind of lay back. So the question of nature and nurture, it's a balance, both ingredients. What's really interesting, and what I'll talk about in the final session, is the way in which our social decisions come to shape our the nature that we face, what we think of as the natural. Because right there I talked about, I can make choices of not having a child, or of not having a child with Huntington disease, risk even, no risk of passing it on, because I could choose to use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. I could use and only implant the egg that doesn't carry that gene and not run the risk of having an egg that does. There's a 50-50 chance. I could avoid the crippling gaze of the public of why did you run that risk of having a child with Huntington disease by having a donor, by either, you know, not having a child or by having an egg donor, avoiding, you know, the problem entirely. And so it is also then possible for the crippling public gaze, right, or society to exert enough influence that no one ever chooses to have a child at risk of Huntington disease. And so then it would become incredibly rare to have such a child. Same is true of Down syndrome children. And in fact, there's a much lower incidence of children with Down syndrome in this country. So we're shaping what's natural. We're shaping the incidence of the genes in future generations by our own individual choices. We're also shaping the incidence of cardiovascular disease because, let's say, we don't do anything about the genes or make reproductive decisions based on the genes for cardiovascular disease, but we have a really bad air quality in Pittsburgh, and that has an effect on cardiovascular disease. We're shaping the incidence of that through our factories and so on. We're shaping what the quality of our water and our air is with our fracking, with our industry, and so forth. So the nature-nurture divide really kind of begins to break down once we have enough knowledge, and once we think that knowing something creates an opportunity for doing something. And we kind of, it's called actually the colonization of the natural by the social. We take over the natural world by our social actions.
So that social action that you're referring to does not necessarily cascade down into individual action, if I understand what you're saying correctly. Because for instance, let's say I have that Huntington's disease gene. Well, I might have the options that you described if I have economic privilege and the privilege of access to genetic testing and fertility reproductive services. But if I have very limited access to healthcare than the way healthcare is structured, no way am I going to get that option. That's my option is to have a child or not. None of that implantation, none of that egg donor, that's not even on the horizon.
That's right. And those are still social choices to have a child or not, physical violence aside.
You mean I have access to reproductive health choices?
Yes, yeah, if you do. And the kind of kicker here is that families affected by Huntington disease, over the years have had lower incomes, in part because their elders have suffered Huntington disease, earlier dementia, loss of income, loss of wealth, not able to hand this down over generations. So people who might benefit very much from assistance in reproduction to avoid having children with the same condition are precisely those who don't have funding for those expensive, extra ancillary healthcare, non-basic healthcare, if you will.
I have a question. This has to do with the medical practice and the doctor-patient relationship. Mm-hmm. What effect will precision medicine have on the practice of medicine? I mean, I've talked to doctors who complain about, government interference, how the practice has changed. But if you think of a medical malpractice case, if a doctor has the option of practicing precision medicine and chooses to not follow that because of the doctor-patient relationship where they believe they have a more of a holistic approach to medicine, would that change the standard of care? Will this change the standard of care to which doctors are held in malpractice cases? When you have this precision medicine available, you have this sharpest scalpel you could use. Why didn't you use it?
Well, one reason might be because your patient said, I don't want to know that genetic information. But precision medicine isn't only about genetics. So I think, yes, in fact, physicians will, it will change the standard of care. It will precision, like pharmacogenomics, testing to see whether your patient is going to respond well to clopidogrel or not, is going to become standard. It is actually a black box, kind of not a warning, but information about there is a genetic test to see how effective this will be. Similarly, there are going to be tests for other drugs. And why wouldn't a person do that? Why wouldn't a physician want to know, is this drug or that drug going to be more likely to be more effective for my patient? Why wouldn't a patient want that? But that's just to say that it's just a new tool. I mean, you wouldn't be giving antibiotics, empirically based on your hunch, if you had a really quick test that was relatively inexpensive that you could use to be sure that this is a bacterial infection that's going to be amenable to treatment with antibiotics. So in that regard, genetics, it's not a wholesale change of medical practice. Even precision medicine is not. It's a tool. And I think people just shouldn't be completely bedazzled by the idea, but instead it's a tool to better inform clinical practice, just as all evidence-based medicine is a tool to inform clinical practice. And we'll talk, please come back, because we'll talk more about how that might work and work really effectively and what choices physicians and patients have and should still have, no matter what we do in terms of our genomic medicine or precision medicine. I realize that we're probably at a quarter of, and you may all have places you need to go, but I can stay here for a bit.
So I'm going to stop the recording and say thank you very much. This has been wonderful. So much to think about.